Good morning. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel this morning is to my right, Justice Ann Gardner. To my left, Justice Bill Meyer. I'm Leanne Dofano. And we have one case set for argument this morning, and that's you. So we'll get started.
May it please the court. Our case today, I think the real important part of this case is resolving the construction of the contract, because until we determine what the contract means and what the rules are under which we're going to evaluate the evidence, then the no evidence point is kind of hard to evaluate. Looking back on this, I guess trying to figure out where maybe I went wrong on this deal, I probably should have conceded the contention of the defendant, the appellee here, that the contract in question, the provision that provided that in the event of a loss of exempt status, the tenant could terminate the lease, probably should have conceded that that was going to be terminate the lease without penalty if that provision applies, because there is a conflict between that provision and the one that says that if you terminate the lease, you have to pay a 10% of the remaining rental balance to terminate. And the reason that's important is because, obviously, the first thing the court has to do is construe those provisions and say, look, is there a conflict between these, and how do we resolve that? And in doing so, the court seems to have gone off on a tangent about there being an ambiguity which entitles the court to consider parole evidence. And from that point on, it seems that we are reading things into the contract which simply aren't there. And of course, our contention in the brief is that if there is an ambiguity between those provisions, then you can resolve that ambiguity by applying the rule of construction that contracts should be construed so that each provision is given meaning and none are rendered meaningless or moot.
Well, if you concede, you're not conceding. You said as you were assuming it was ambiguous in your brief.
Right. And I would say there's an ambiguity there. If you want to say that the 10% provision, they wouldn't need the additional provision regarding may terminate if the only way you could terminate is by paying 10%. So I'll concede that there's an ambiguity to that extent. It wouldn't make sense to have that provision unless there was a possibility that you could terminate without paying the remaining 10%. So I'll concede that. But what we don't concede, and what the court has effectively done, is to read out of the contract the provision that says the parties will cooperate to obtain any available tax exemption for the property. We believe that the proper construction of the agreement is that the parties must, not only at the outset, but throughout the term of the contract, cooperate to obtain any available tax exemption. Now, if, having done that, the tenant is unable to obtain tax-exempt status, or perhaps the law changes so that they simply can't get it, then I think the provision allowing them to terminate the lease impliedly without further penalty would apply. But you don't get there unless the parties have first cooperated to achieve any available tax exemption for the property. And that's where this case boils down to. When you read the findings of fact that the trial court filed, number 8 is really instructive. It said, while using the property to house evacuees for Hurricane Katrina, the defendant began looking for other continuing uses of the property after the eventual departure of the Hurricane Katrina evacuees. Defendant did not find another use for the property that met the purposes and criteria set by the defendant. Now, you can go and look at this lease all day long, and you will find nothing in the lease that limits the uses of the property in any way, and particularly any provision that says that the property only has to be used for things that meet the purposes and criteria set by the defendant. The court has just pulled this out from nowhere, and I think it's done that because it's concluded that parole evidence is admissible, and therefore I can look at what the parties really intended, and this was really to house Hurricane Katrina evacuees, even though that's not what the lease says. The only reference to Hurricane Katrina evacuees is the provision regarding rent reductions, and it says that rent will not be reduced, and they had a provision in there where my clients would take a charitable tax deduction in exchange for lowering the rent on it. They said this provision won't apply if the tenant is compensated by FEMA for housing evacuees to that extent. That's the only reference to housing evacuees. It's not saying that this is the sole purpose for which the lease is granted. It's not saying that this is the only purpose for which the tenant can use the property. It's simply saying that if this happens, then the rental reduction provision does not apply.
You look only at the contract, it appears to provide that they've got to try to get it in the first place. But as soon as it's denied or suspended, then they can get out. And it doesn't say anything about it's not being as a result of their own actions or that they've got to try to resecure an exemption.
It doesn't say that they have to initially cooperate to achieve any available exemption. It says that they shall cooperate to achieve any available exemption. And I read that provision like any other provision, the provision to pay rent, the provision to maintain the premises, as applying throughout the term of the lease. I can't think of any reason why this provision should only apply one time and not at any other point during the term of the agreement. Once we get to that point and say that, okay, we've got an obligation of the parties to obtain any available tax exemption, and if they cooperated and couldn't achieve it, fine, but if they didn't, then they're going to be held liable. So then we have to look at the evidence on the no evidence question. And we think that the pastor's admission that they could have used this property for things such as a Bible study and thereby achieved a tax-exempt status even after all the hurricane evacuees left.
But there isn't their testimony, even the maybe it could have been disregarded by the court if he wanted to, isn't there testimony that that was not feasible?
I don't see where the contract imposes any feasibility standard on the defendant.
What about reasonable?
I could see an argument about reasonability if we were saying that the exempt purpose, that they should have engaged in some exempt activity which they don't already engage in. I could see an argument for that, but we're not asking them to do anything which they weren't already doing elsewhere. They simply did not want to conduct their activities at this place because they found it to be financially prohibitive. And that is not an excuse for terminating the contract, for deciding that, oh, I made a bad deal. That was not what was contemplated. What was contemplated was that if circumstances change such that they couldn't get a tax exemption, for example, the law could change so that these type of activities were no longer taxes. If the legislature come in and say that religious organizations can claim a tax-exempt status for a worship facility and nothing else, if that happens, fine. That's, I think, the type of situation that's contemplated by the loss of exempt status provision. Not simply that the church decides that it's losing money on this operation and that it's not a wise expenditure of their funds, because they entered into this agreement freely and agreed to pay the rent and agreed and obligated for the terms. They didn't say in here, we'll only do this so long as we find it convenient or profitable to us. There are lots of tenants who would love to be able to say, well, I'm not obligated to pay my rent anymore because I don't find it financially feasible. And I don't think that you can read any of the provisions in this lease to say that that's what the parties contemplated, that the parties would defer to the church's determination of what's reasonable and feasible. There's no limitation on use. They took a 20-year lease on this property, and there's no conceivable way that they could have figured they were going to be housing Hurricane Katrina evacuees for 20 years. Obviously, the parties contended. They knew that they were dealing with the church. It's a church that obtains exempt status for multiple properties in Wichita County, not just its worship facility. They're well aware that this property had gotten exempt status in the past for a similar residential property. nonprofit use. So the parties thought, as long as the state of the law is that way, that you can get exempt status, then we're going to hold you to this agreement. They're going to pay the rent, and we'll go with the rental deductions and whatnot and give you the option to purchase it. I don't think there's any way that the court could believe that the parties came to a mutual agreement that Evangel Temple could decide on its own whether or not it was financially reasonable to continue using the property. There's just nothing in the lease to justify that. But having admitted that they could have gotten exempt status, I don't think the court was free to disregard that type of testimony. I think that's the type of admission that was talked about, I believe, in the City of Keller case, that courts may not disregard an admission of that sort. I understand the court's duty as fact finder, but when a party says, yes, I could have had an exempt use for the property, that should pretty much end the argument, as far as I'm concerned, on the evidence. There's just no way that a reasonable fact finder could find other than that they could have obtained exempt status and simply decided not to.
Doing what?
They could have had a Bible study. There was the example that the pastor used. If they said, we're going to have a weekly Bible study, the appraisal district would have said, fine, that's your use. Submit a new a form, and we'll grant you an exemption for that. He was aware of that. They did that at other properties in Wichita County. They had this master's commission program at another program at another property that was discontinued, and then the property actually sat vacant for a couple months before they started using it for a Bible study type deal. In no time did they go in and change the exempt status on that property. Nobody even questioned it. They knew they were going to be able to get exempt status so long as they kept using it for religious purposes. But on that property, they didn't have what they saw as an available out to get out of the lease. On this one, they said, aha, we've got this termination provision. We're going to take advantage of it and get out from this financial obligation.
Was this period of time that they decided to get out at about the same time that their rent was going to jump from $3,000 to $10,000?
Yeah, the rent reductions were coming to an end, and in fact, I believe the records will show that they ended up paying, making a reimbursement after they received some FEMA money during that rental reduction period. But other than that, the only full rental payment they made was at the very end of the lease agreement. So they had not been really feeling the financial burden of this lease as such. And the moment that they do, all of a sudden, well, we can't use the property anymore. You're exactly right. That's what the record reflects, is that they used it as long as it didn't really cost them anything, but once it was going to cost them something, they got out of there. So in a nutshell, I really think that when you construe the agreement and give every provision meaning, you have to conclude that the continuing obligation to achieve any available tax exemption tempers that provision that says that they can terminate upon loss of exempt status. Otherwise, you're effectively reading that provision out of the agreement, because why would, I mean, you're reading out the 10% provision from the agreement. Why would any tenant who has this contract then ever opt for the 10% provisions? Because all they got to do is say, I don't want to use it anymore. I don't think there's a feasible use, at which point they'd lose their exempt status. If that's the construction.
Well, the trial court found that they made a good faith effort to find other use.
What they found was that they did not find another use that met the purposes and criteria set by the defendant.
Okay.
And that doesn't appear anywhere in the lease. And the reason it doesn't just say good faith effort, because for one thing, that doesn't appear in the lease. The lease says any available tax exemption. And they certainly could have used this for a Bible study or something of that sort. Even if it didn't make financial sense or wasn't wise, they could have done it. They could have maintained exempt status. They simply didn't do that because they felt they made a bad deal.
Was there extrinsic evidence admitted that that's what they intended, or the parties intended, was for them to have to find a use that met their criteria?
I don't recall anything exactly on that sort. I mean, there was certainly lots of testimony that everybody knew we were going to house hurricane evacuees, but there was also testimony from the officers of Evangel Temple that this was a 20-year lease, and they knew that they weren't going to be housing evacuees there forever. They obviously intended that to have a long-term use for it, and this was not going to be it. So they knew they were going to have to find another use at some point. I'll reserve the balance of my time since I see we're getting close to the end. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Good morning.
If it pleases the court, I'm John Lane. As I listen to what Tom has to say, I would like to sort of cut through the chase. I'm glad we do agree with Tom to acquiesce that there was an ambiguity in the contract. I think that pretty much takes care of their argument number one. Even if you look at contract construction, there was no way that you were going to read the words without further liability into that termination clause. The only way that the court could do that was the way that the court did it, which was looking at the intent of the parties, getting the testimony of the parties. And it was through the testimony of the parties that it was uncontroverted, hey, that was our intention. It didn't make it into the lease. And part of the reason there is due to, I mean, this was a rush job, and this was a bad contract that was entered into. There's no doubt about it. Neither Tom nor I actually drafted this contract. We came in after the fact. They started talking after Hurricane Katrina within a matter of days, and then within that week, the contract was there. Woods Care Center presented the first copy of the contract. This provision was an argued provision that happened during the week between the parties, and there you go. It's a rush contract. They didn't take the steps that they should have taken, and had they, we probably would not be here today.
Woods drafted the contract?
The original contract was presented by Woods. The provision in question, this, you know, that the parties, the available tax exemption way out, was a point that was argued over and actually added later on. So that was not in Wood's original contract.
Isn't church property traditionally tax exempt? I mean, if the church had said nothing, it would continue to be tax exempt because it was church property, and the church certainly wasn't operating it at a profit.
I agree with that. That had the church said nothing, the property would have maintained its tax exemption. That is true. The problem is, when they applied for their tax exemption, they received a nice letter from this county that said, look, according to Texas law, you have to inform us if the stated reason that was given for this property, this tax exemption, changes. And they actually waited almost 2 months after the last evacuee left before they made that notification.
So the stated reason was to house evacuees, not that it's church property?
That is correct.
So they could get out later?
No, ma'am. It was, I believe Chad Sykes was a sort of a junior pastor there at the church, and he filled out that application. And there was some testimony, I believe, that he let Wood know, hey, this is what we're doing. We're filing our application. We're going to apply for the status. And it was granted under that reason. There was no testimony whatsoever, nor, I think, belief of either parties that at the time there was a contemplation of using this to get out.
But it was still church property. Wasn't it still subject to the tax exemption as church property?
It could be if they wanted to change the use to say that the church was using that property. I don't think the church gets a blanket exemption just because they're a church for any property they lease gets that tax exemption. They have to go through the process of showing what the use of the property is to obtain that tax exemption. That's my understanding, at least.
Well, when churches buy property to hold until they can tear down the buildings to extend their parking lot, it's considered church property and tax exempt, isn't it?
If they've applied for that exemption, I believe that's correct, yes.
Well, why didn't they apply for that exemption? The church had the lease, had the property there to be used. Why did they refuse to get it exempt as church property?
because we're talking about a piece of property that is nowhere
that they didn't want anymore.
Under your example, you're talking about an adjacent property that they are going to have a use for.
No, I'm just talking about church property. It doesn't have to be used for church services. Church property's traditionally exempt, isn't it?
Only if it has an exempt purpose, I believe. I don't think you get a blanket exemption
so
just to be a church.
If your lease had said only so long as it is habitable for the intended use, are you saying if y'all had gone in and started a fire, it would have gotten you out from under the lease?
No, I don't believe they're saying that at all. That was not a contention.
What's the difference between doing something to cause it not to be habitable and doing something to cause it not to be tax exempt?
I think that can be cleared up if you look at the totality of the contract of the provision that's at issue. It doesn't just say if you lose or don't gain tax exempt status. It says that they believe by virtue of the tenant's operation at the facility that they will gain a tax exemption. It doesn't say by virtue of who the tenant is. It doesn't say by virtue of them being a church. It says by virtue of what they're doing at the property. So the contract itself lays out that that was the understanding of the parties, that it's not just tax exemption because you're a church. It's tax exemption because of what you're doing. The problem is, and where I disagree with Tom substantially, is the testimony regarding those available uses. Take a drink just 1 second, if
sure.
I may. The testimony was, there were only, I believe, 5 sections of testimony for whether they could have available uses. Mr. Key wants to pinpoint the one little area where Pastor Kyle says, well, I guess it's possible, a Bible study is possible in the sense that anything's possible. And it was being used almost rhetorically in the sense of, well, you know, I guess I could quit what I'm doing tomorrow and go be a brain surgeon. Anything's possible. The problem is there's later testimony to clarify that. And if you look at the context of the 5 things that were brought up, that later testimony showed that there is no direct testimony saying that those things were possible at the property. The Master's Commission, as Tom himself stated, there was another building that was being used as a residential housing for it was almost like a school type setting. And the pastor there, who was in charge of that and started the process, moved down to the Metroplex and basically took the students with him. They didn't have a purpose there. They found a later purpose. It was not just a Bible study, and I think the record will show that. They found a later residential purpose for that building, but that was actually found prior to Katrina victims moving out. So timing doesn't match up. And at the time that the Katrina victims left, there was no such program that was in operation, such as the Master's Commission.
Mr. Lane.
Yes, sir.
On your brief on page 15, at the bottom in the paragraph, it says that Texas Property Tax Code Chapter 11 required a notice letter. Do you know what section you're referencing there of the code? I read through that code in the whole chapter. I didn't see a specific provision that says you shall give notice if a purpose of use for which an exemption has been granted is no longer applicable.
Well, off the top of my head, I cannot recall what that exact code section is, and I apologize if that is a misstatement in the brief. It's something I don't want to talk unintelligently about. I know at the time I wrote it, I thought I knew what I was talking about, but I cannot remember at this
point.
Did
you participate in the writing of the letter to give the notice?
No, I did not.
Okay, thank you.
Back to these other uses. There was a question that was put to Pastor Kyle as to whether there was the availability of holding services there. Pastor Kyle's testimony comes back, and so does the testimony of Chad Sykes, that, look, no, the size of the facility and the way that it's segmented into rooms doesn't give the possibility of any of the services that we have for that size of a facility. The question of a Bible study, there was later testimony that went back and said, look, we don't have a Bible study to send out there. There's no Bible study asking to go. I, as the senior pastor, said Pastor Kyle, can't order this to go out there. That's not the way our church works. The need has to be expressed, and we have to send them somewhere. And to top that off, they had been trying since November to find further uses, and here it is June. And from November to June, although several things had been tried and things had gotten to the advanced stages, nothing had come about. Nothing. They could not bring anything about, and they were actually really trying. And I think the testimony will lay that out. But Pastor Kyle's testimony later goes on to say, look, the sense that anything's possible for a Bible study, we're using that in a super broad sense. Actually, feasibly, there was no Bible study to move out there, and that's what the testimony says. The Mosaic meeting, the testimony was, look, the facility does not have the size criteria that we need for the Mosaic meeting. And I think it was actually that the rooms were too, some of the rooms were too small and some of the rooms were too big, and that due to what they do, and I don't know what that is, it required a certain size requirement that was being met elsewhere, and so that facility wouldn't work. And lastly, I think there was testimony regarding an angel food ministry, and the testimony was, no, that requires docking bays and forklifts, and the way this building is structured, it doesn't have any of those things, and you couldn't use it for that. So apart from those five things, there was no testimony given at all at court as to even another possible use of the property. And I think Woods relies very heavily upon that flippant comment, well, anything's possible. And they hinge their entire belief on that. And I think when you look at the totality of the testimony, they pretty much shored up that, no, there actually isn't another use for the property at the time, even though they had tried for many months.
Did they revoking of the tax exemption come about when the church first gave the notice that the Katrina use had ended, or did it come about after the several months of attempting to find another use?
The Katrina victims left in the 1st of May, and I believe that's 06. They waited to send the letter evidently until the end of June. And actually, there is a missed date in the brief. I think it says that they sent it on the 20th. They actually sent it on the 30th. So the 30th is when they terminated the lease. The 29th, which is the day before, is when they sent the letter to the city that said, look, we don't have an ongoing use. We understand that we're letting you know we don't have an ongoing tax exempt use for the property. And we understand that probably means that tax exemption is going to be pulled. They say that very plainly. And then that day, they received a fax that said, yes, the tax exempt status is pulled. And then it was the very next day that they sent a letter terminating the lease, evidently.
Could you address the argument that the lessor makes that about finding number 8, where the court said the defendant did not find another use that met the criteria of the defendant, or words to that effect, and that there is no provision in the lease to that effect?
Well, I think the addressing to that is partly due, if you look at that actual provision, to where Tom wants to say, well, that puts the onus, it doesn't say there has to be a reasonable use, it doesn't mean there has to be a finite use. But actually, I think it does, because it's by the operation on the property wherein you gain that tax-exempt status, not just the status of the church as a church. And there's testimony that, yes, there was a limited back and forth between the parties on trying to find that tax exemption. So there was a cooperation. I think the argument is sort of a red herring, because in actuality there was a cooperation. Whether the court's finding says that was unnecessary or not, there actually was the cooperation there. And there were back and forth between the parties in trying to find this tax exempt status. I don't know if that answered your question.
That's fine.
Got a couple of minutes.
I have nothing further unless you have questions of me.
Questions? Any questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Just real briefly, a couple of points. First off, as to the testimony of Pastor Bateman, that testimony, like all the other testimony at trial, was under oath. And the pastor was asked point blank if they could have used it for a Bible study. He said, yes, we could have. We had significant testimony about his understanding that, or his belief that they only had to do things which were reasonable and effective. I think he, I quote that in my brief where he talks about, well, if it's approved by the church, if it's this, if it's that. None of that appears in the lease. And while I would concede that there might be some circumstances where you would say that's an unreasonable exempt use that we're not going to require you to make of the property, I don't think there's anything in this case saying that we're asking them to do that. We're not asking them to engage in any use of this property that they don't do elsewhere, nor are we asking them to, were we asking them to do any use that they weren't doing away from their main worship facility. They have maintained tax-exempt status on the Maureen Street property, another property located elsewhere in the city, which they own and on which they pay a note that they can't get out from under. When they lost the use they had on that, they waited a couple of months, but they found another use. They maintained their exempt status throughout, and they never sent the appraisal district notice that their use changed. Now, perhaps they should have. But if they had, they would have received the exempt status. The appraisal district is pretty apparent from the facts, is pretty forgiving on granting you exempt status if you're using the property for religious purposes. Now, when they filed their application, they didn't list religious purposes, and I'm not going to read any motive into that and say that they were trying to scheme for a way out at that point in time. They just simply listed what they intended to use it for at the onset. But they couldn't have reasonably believed that they were going to fulfill a 20-year lease with that same use for the duration of the lease. It just wasn't feasible.
Mr. Key.
Yes, sir.
The language in the lease at the paragraph we're talking about on exemption says both parties agree to cooperate with each other to achieve any available property tax exemption. I don't understand that to be a matter that you contest. In other words, there was cooperation in an effort to try to achieve property tax exemption.
At the onset, absolutely. They fulfilled that at the onset. Our contention is that once the evacuees left, they did not do things that they could have done to achieve an available tax
exemption. Well, does the lease say that they must do everything possible to try to achieve the tax exemption?
It says they agree to cooperate to achieve any available property tax exemption. I don't know of any way to read that other than to say that if you could get a tax exemption for holding a Bible study, you have to do that. That's
okay. Well, in terms of the rest of the language in that paragraph, if you read the language there, it doesn't require any condition of precondition to exist other than there being a denial or suspension of the exemption as an option to terminate the lease, does it?
No, it doesn't say that there has to be any other conditions.
Okay.
Those sentences are drafted kind of in.
Well, they're all the very clear printed language in the lease, though, aren't they?
They are, but you have to give each language, each provision meaning. And if you construe the termination on loss of exempt status the way the church and the court did in this case, that renders their obligation to obtain any available tax exemption meaningless. It renders the 10% termination provision meaningless because nobody would ever opt for the 10% termination. All they do is simply stop using it and say, appraisal district, I'm not using it for my exempt purpose anymore. Terminate my exempt status so I can go terminate my lease.
Well, why does it say, in your understanding of the way the evidence was presented on the intentions under the lease in the trial court, the next sentence says, if notwithstanding the denial of such property tax exemption, tenant elects to continue. So isn't that giving the tenant two choices? That is, if there is a denial of property tax exemption, then that's a question of termination. But if they continue, then there is yet another option that then they're responsible for the payment of property taxes.
I think they drafted this intention, both these provisions, with the intention that if the law changed or the appraisal district changed its policy such that they lost their tax-exempt status through, even though they did everything they could to obtain any available tax exemption, then they had the option to continue or not at their option at that point. And that's what I believe those provisions mean. I can explain that further if you'd like, but I see my time's up.
Thank you for answering my question, sir.
Okay.
Any other questions?
No.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. We appreciate your argument. Your case is submitted. We really appreciate your driving all the way down here. I know it was not easy, particularly in Stock Show, during Stock Show, because of all the extra traffic. So appreciate your being here. This court will be adjourned.
All right.